Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This is the Season 6 wrap. We'll start with the Season 6 finale. Then I will include a short excerpt of my conversation with medievalist Brian Pavlak. Check out his book, Game of Thrones vs. History Written in Blood. Finally, I address some listener feedback on the question of where's the climax in this book. Just one housekeeping note. When Electric Boogaloo comes back in a couple weeks, I'm going to go to a 2-episode per week format. So I'm going to split up my conversation between the show and the books. So you can look forward to that in a couple weeks. Without further ado, here is comic Steve Osborne.
Man, I'm going to tell you right now that this opening sequence, the score, it was to me, you talk about the last episode and how much you love it. That opening sequence was about pitch perfect all the way to the explosion.
Yeah, and I don't know if they've used piano before. I mean, that was a very haunting. Everything about that was just so ominous, right? You know, right. Something horrible is going to happen.
Easily the most tense I've been for any extended period of time watching the show.
Okay.
Right. I was so hooked. They did. It was about, again, it's perfect. And again, this is something that other shows, that's how the season ends, right?
Oh, absolutely. And this is how they start the episode.
Right? Yeah. So that was the part where I was like, wow, that's how we coming out the gate on this one. So I was very, very pleased. This whole episode to me was one of the best I've seen so far out of the series.
It's really quite amazing to see, because Battle of the Bastards was so good, but for so many different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you were really just focused on Dany's war and Jon's war. But this one was all over the place. You could have ended this episode like 9 different times, like,
right.
You know, huge moments that you could end. You could have ended on Arya's revenge for the Red Wedding.
Right.
You could have ended on Cersei sitting the Iron Throne. I mean, there's so many places that you could have ended this thing. King of the North, all of that business.
Right.
All right. So I loved how Margaery was kind of the only one in the room that, like, she doesn't know how they're all going to die, but she's pretty sure they're all going to die.
Yeah. Well, and then you see what happens, and it's like, even if she had gotten out, like, right away, there's... It would have been all for naught.
Yeah.
That explosion was pretty massive.
I loved that you started the episode with the church bells ominously ringing.
Mm-hmm.
And then the explosion happens.
And then a church bell just straight up murders somebody.
Oh, man. It's like a VW bug just smashing through the streets. That was wonderful. Steve, I do not like little kids with knives.
Man, see, that's the other thing. I mean, talk about, and that probably added to the tension. You're just watching these kids just go bananas, and it was just, honestly, like, it could have been a 15-minute episode, and I would have been 100% satisfied.
He must be giving those kids some really great candy.
Either that, or it's just enough candy to get them so amped. They're just so amped on candy that they don't even know. I mean, we all been there. You had that Halloween. You tell your kids, "All right, you can have a few." They sneak a few, and the next
thing
you know,
red dye.
Next thing you know, they're just like, "There's murder in their hearts." They probably just told the guy that, "Hey, this is
the story for Halloween."
No, this is the origin story for pinatas. I mean, that's what they were telling them. That guy's full of candy. Get him.
Oh man! Oh geez, this episode was relentless.
It was so good. I was kind of blown away at how much I liked it. Like, it was, the feeling, the overwhelming sense of tension that I had in the beginning was like, I'm like, how do you start this way? And so it's interesting, because then now you're just going on this wild journey. And I, cause again, I think I like the way that they really, really play up Loras's trial. So I mean, they really lull you. Then when it all is said and done, it's like, well, who cares, because he just got wiped out. So all of that was meaningless, you know what I mean, in terms of what it means for the overall narrative. And so the fact that you sit through it and then all this other stuff happened, like that was incredible. It was like, it's a real great sense of misdirection too.
I want to put a little bow on our Mace Tyrell conversations. There is no way, Steve, that Loras and Margaery have any genetic connection to Mace Tyrell. There's absolutely no way that that guy birthed that god and goddess. I mean, they are the two of the most attractive people on Earth, and I just can't see them coming from Mace.
Skips a gen.
Suppose so. I think that maybe, you know, Jon Snow is clearly not fathered by Ned Stark. Maybe Rhaegar Targaryen was just fathering kids all over the
kingdom. That's right. He's just spraying his seed everywhere he goes.
Man, so Grand Maester Pycelle is a pincushion.
Yeah.
Margaery's gone. Loras is gone. The High Sparrow is gone.
Yeah, I just love this. There's something about seeing Cersei, a monster, and Qyburn. It's just something so... How you're speaking my language, man.
Cersei's all in black now.
Yeah.
And I thought that... Okay, so...
Sith Lord.
Yeah, right. Exactly. She's the Sith Lord, right? So if you remember how this season began, it was Cersei receiving a prophecy that all of her children would die, right?
Right.
And so it was a weird flashback. Like, we don't really ever see a lot of flashbacks in this show.
Mm-hmm.
But she's kind of living her life at least suspicious that all of her children are going to die.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, she freaks out that Joffrey's gone. But by the time Myrcella and Tommen go, I think she plays that scene really well, when it's kind of like she's grieving, but she's not all that surprised.
Yeah, it feels like it felt like after the daughter died, she was kind of reserved to the idea that this prophecy was right. And I'm just going to have to sort of accept that and not let that. I mean, it's interesting. Like so you mentioned the concept of, the resurrection kind of concept, the rebirth of sure. Dany and Jon Snow. And it's like, if you really look at it, I mean, this whole series is about some sort of rebirth for like each character and how they are like wrestling with or settling into mm-hmm. who they are. I think the walk
death
of
and rebirth is a big thing. I mean, we saw that with the Hound just recently.
Right. And the walk of shame with Cersei, I think, certainly changed her. Right. I mean, I think that so it's interesting that the High Sparrow broke her, but not in the sense that he broke Loras. He almost broke her of any and all, whatever goodness that she could sort of tap into or feign for the mm-hmm. sake of her children, pretty much gone. Like, she's now different. Like, again, going back to that, we think we talked about it either last week or before, or how kind of Arya was kind of like a proxy Lady Stoneheart for this sort of hellbent on revenge.
Sure.
You can make that same case for a lot of these folks, right? Like, there's kind of, you kind of have two options. You either become uber justice, or you go revenge, because you see that as a justice type of thing, justice for you. And because Jamie's boring now. He's got one hand. He's got a nice haircut and a kick-ass leather jack. But for the most part,
yeah. Jamie's return, sort of shocking return to King's Landing, and just seeing the Sept completely decimated, and then watching his sister and lover or whatever ascending to the Iron Throne. At that point, he's like, he's just a full on spectator, and she's so outpaced him that it's really difficult to see how. I mean, I guess the point is, it was really quite arresting how shocked he was about how this all went down.
Yeah. Sort of this, like, I leave the castle for 1 minute.
I know. He's like, he's feeling pretty good about himself. He's thinking, hey, I got River Run.
That's yeah. Pretty great.
Blackface is dead. And, you know, Edmure's back in the old dungeon.
Should be a good time for some celebratory incest.
Yeah, he comes back and realizes, oh, wait, Cersei's now a Sith Lord. Okay, all right. Tommen, suicide plus regicide. So both of these things. Now you called it, but I'm guessing you didn't. Did you know that was going to happen when you saw him looking out the window?
That's when I was like, and Heather called that too. So I didn't even mention my prediction at this point to her because I didn't want to, if I was right, I don't want to like introduce a spoiler that even if it's not one that I know is a spoiler, you know what I mean?
Sure, like, sure, sure.
And so she's like, oh, I bet he's going out that window. So I think it feels like it's sort of directed that way.
I was totally shocked when I first saw it. I was
there, right?
I just never thought Tommen
had it in him.
Had it in him. I really
to make any decision. So no, the idea that it was just like he's just like I'm so in over my head. I don't know what to do.
Or that everything he was just so in love with Marjorie.
Sort of. And he'd committed himself to this High Sparrow. And
yeah.
And
he's a true believer and he's in love with Marjorie. Like the two things that give him any meaning at all just went up and.
Right. And then on the other hand, you're like, and I know my mother didn't approve of any of that. And now I got to go deal with that.
Yeah. Maybe part of it's kind of like, maybe he knows his mom did it. And maybe he's like, well, she doesn't get to have me.
Yeah, there's a lot there, right? I mean, like, because I think he's aware that Cersei's capable of quite a bit.
Yeah.
Or at least he has enough, like, fear, right? And so if that's the case, it's like, well, you know, forget all this. What am I living for? So, I mean, I'm like, all right, I didn't expect it to go that way, but it was nice to have a little prediction.
So this episode, more than any other, provided closure for the Red Wedding.
Right.
Because you've got John who finally defeats the Boltons, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you get a call back for that in that enthronement scene up north. And then of course Arya decides that she's going to literally make mincemeat of Blackwalder and Lothar.
Yeah, that was like as soon as the servant or whatever said they're here, I'm like, oh, he's eating them.
And then she gets her little, you know, Mission Impossible moment,
right? Which does add a little confusion because they're like, so she still gets to do faces, huh?
Yeah, I guess she can do faces.
So that's that part didn't. You know, that was. Oh, she earned that one, I guess.
Well, she stole a face, I suppose. Or she knows how to make a face work now. I don't.
Yeah. I mean, I guess there's enough. She did enough training for that. So I'm like, all right, I'll allow it.
And she's just kind of reveling in this. Well, okay, first of all, it's pretty cold blooded. It's pretty cold blooded. So she's the same girl that was kind of giving eyes to Jaime Lannister earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And let me just say that Bronn is significantly better company than Walder Frey. So that made me think like, okay, so maybe Jaime's next, but I don't know. I don't know about that.
Yeah,
because I thought that there was going to be some payoff between that girl and Jaime, and then of course it turns out to be Arya, which I didn't really see coming until I saw the thumb in the pie.
Yeah,
and then of course it's like, oh yeah, that's Arya. Poor Edmure back in the cell.
Yeah, Edmure just, I mean, that seems like his official title is Poor Edmure.
Poor Edmure. That's right. Sam gets to be in, like, nerd paradise.
Yeah, I suppose. Sam's an interesting, it's an interesting character to watch because it's just like, I'm like, it's every, I mean, I feel like I've been every time I'm anywhere with Sam, I'm like, well, Sam is like the guy that should be dead by now, like in many different ways. Not just in the fact that he can't really fight real well or all this stuff, but just because you make him so, they've done such a good job of like, he's in so endearing that like, I'm like, endearing yeah. just that doesn't survive.
Right. No, endearing makes his death a motivator for Jon Snow or Gilly or someone like that.
Right.
Davos and Mel finally have their, I mean, this episode is packed.
Yeah. And he doesn't, you know, Davos doesn't go to kill her or anything. He just orders her execution.
Well, he makes a speech. I mean,
that's what he does.
He gave that. Those were his harshest words.
Look, I may not be a highborn executor.
So, okay. John shows her mercy. She's a child murderer.
He doesn't know the exact circumstances of how it went down. I mean, she did it, but it's also like, hey, also Stannis.
She said she burned her at the stake.
Yeah, he says we all did. It's Stannis and the mom, and I had a permission slip.
Steve, I really think we should talk about the Tower of Joy. Tower of Joy.
Okay.
So, Bran goes back into his little time warp.
Mm-hmm.
And he sees Ned going up the stairs. This time he doesn't yell, but Ned turns around anyway. Did you catch that?
I did catch that, yeah.
So, that's somewhat interesting. He goes upstairs and he overhears a conversation between Lyanna, Ned's younger sister, and Ned.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you're like everyone else, you paused it and turned on subtitles.
No.
Oh, all right. Okay. Well, I'm curious what you make of that conversation.
I caught that. Because of the like, it was pretty low, right?
Pretty low. You couldn't really hear what they were saying, but I think that scene is supposed to reveal something, and I just want to.
Yeah, I mean, I caught that. You know, he had to take the credit for, or he had a responsibility for the baby,
right?
Because Robert would have it killed.
Okay, so you heard, I think you heard the necessary parts of the conversation. I think the subtitles just kind of say whisper.
Okay.
Most
so I didn't
of it,
miss the whisper part.
You know, I, the important part of the conversation was that you know Robert will do something to the baby or something.
Right. So the big reveal is that it's interesting how like Ned gets uncomplicated in one aspect, but then more complicated in another, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Because on one hand, it's like, wow, I mean, he really was faithful to Catelyn, but also he was okay with letting that die with her. At him.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, and in addition to that, you know, we go to the very next scene, and I think everyone who's shouting King in the North is assuming that this is Ned Stark's son, right?
Right.
So would they be shouting that had, you know, if they knew that this is actually not, I mean, it's Ned Stark's nephew, right? So that's not nothing.
But I mean, you've also got his daughter right there, right?
Right.
So that's where I think you end up with the, that's where the complication really lies. Because we're seeing this, because there's already, I mean, that, it's already kind of complicated because Littlefinger already sort of plants this seed to Sansa. I don't think we're really clear at this point how that seed is being taken.
Right. I think that I was, you know, what I wrote down. You could just give me Northmen swords raised shouting King of the North every time. It's going to give me chills. I just,
yeah,
every time. I love it. And then total buzzkill Littlefinger in the corner. Right.
Right. Just, mm. And so I'm trying to interpret that back and forth, like the look at Sansa, like, I don't know if there's an element of like, hey, I told you so, or if it's also a sense of like, well, this isn't exactly going the way I wanted, but with Littlefinger, you never know either.
Yeah. In addition to that, Sansa is, she's lived her life being passed around by men who are considerably more powerful than she is.
Right.
And here again is, you know, she's at the table. She deserves a lot of credit for saving the day, right?
Right.
And now she's kind of sitting watching her, you know, bastard brother receive all of the glory. And then Littlefinger is just sitting there thinking like, yeah, but what about me?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a fascinating thing because if Sansa's not getting the credit, that means Littlefinger's not getting the credit. And the question is, because, and we talk about this all the time, is like, Sansa's probably the most difficult character to read in this series. And again, I'm not sure if that's intentional or not, or if it's just that she's not well fleshed out. And so that part, so that's where I think that's where I live with a certain amount of tension, where I'm like, am I seeing a series flaw, or am I seeing perhaps maybe something kind of brilliant? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think it does bring a bit more tension, knowing, I guess the question is, not knowing how much, is she Ned's daughter or is she Littlefinger's protege? Because if she's a little bit of both, then you're not quite sure how to read that look between the two.
Right, as much as we can understand and as much as we can ever trust Littlefinger, we hear he expresses his explicit intention to, he wants to be on the Iron Throne, and I don't think we've gotten that before. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think we've even talked about in a past episode that he has a plan. We're not exactly sure what the overall deal is, but it's all about expanding, right? He keeps expanding his influence and his power, and it doesn't feel like it's just to watch the world burn. It feels like there's some sort of end game involved. So the idea that he is making overtures to get to the Iron Throne, like, okay, well that makes sense now. And that would be quite a journey to get there. But then at the same time, it's like, well, he's playing his hand, to Sansa, so that either suggests he trusts her or he trusts that she is naive enough to follow him.
Mm-hmm.
And that all assumes that he's being, but I think he sees that, right? I mean, I think what he's saying is like, he's trying to play the I can make you happy love card or whatever it is. Which that in and of itself feels like, if there's a ruse in there, that's probably it, because I don't think he feels that way, other than maybe in some perverse way, but ultimately she's a name he can use.
I suppose so. I think that there is part of him that feels like, my origin story is that I was always in love with Kat. I didn't have enough prestige to be, you know, warranted as a suitor in the Tully eyes or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of what motivated him to rise in the ranks and try to grab more power. So I do think that there's something about the trophy of having Kat's daughter that motivates him.
Yeah, and if he still has a grudge against Ned, that's another.
Sure.
There's a lot personally that can be gained from that. In addition,
I think that there's something about the Iron Throne that is sort of maybe his ultimate goal, but having that little trophy bride on the side is maybe not as big of a goal, but it's kind of important to this vision that he's got for himself.
Right. I mean, this is the ultimate, like, Littlefinger strikes me as a, like, he's, the effort that he's going through is not to get a little, but to get it all.
Yeah. Okay, I do want to talk a little bit more about Jon Snow. So Jon Snow is not Ned's son.
Right. He's kind of a Stark.
He is. Well, his mother, Lyanna, was a Stark.
Right.
His father...
Targaryen.
A Targaryen, which makes Jon at least a bastard Targaryen.
So what does that do? So, yes, I mean, in terms of, so it really doesn't mean a whole lot, right? I mean, in terms of, I mean, he's not like, it'd be one thing if it had been revealed that he was a Baratheon, right? Because then that could put him in a spot for King's Landing. Not that that whole thing is
well,
a
being
mess
a Targaryen,
now,
like. Okay, so Rhaegar Targaryen was next in line for the Iron Throne.
Mm-hmm.
And then Robert
Rebellion,
over,
right.
Yeah, right. So overthrew him. So you could say that given that there are so few Targaryens left, you could say that the bastard of Rhaegar, who had a claim to the throne, has a claim to the throne.
Yeah.
So in addition to that, he is Dany's nephew.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that that certainly has potential to be something, right? Because I mean,
well,
I don't
Targaryens
know.
Targaryens like to keep it in the family, right?
Well, whether they like it, or then in this case, they might not know that, right? I mean, there's this obviously with the Dario Dany sequence. Got to marry somebody,
yeah, right.
And there's not a lot of eligible bachelors out there anymore that are worth a damn. I mean, John's kind of like right now he seems like the obvious choice, right? I mean, if you could unify the North.
Well,
the
and
North.
Then you've got the whole thing about, like, if this really is sort of the Song of Ice and Fire, here you have Dany who rose from the ashes like a phoenix, right?
Right.
So she's sort of like reborn as this fire person, and John is sort of reborn as this, you know, icy corpse or whatever.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, who is a good match for Dany in this show? I mean, it's not Jorah, right?
No. No.
So you, and we know that the Targaryens like to keep it in the family.
Right.
So that was, that's,
and you can do
the
worse than a Jon Snow.
Okay. So, that was one of the big reveals of the series. And I think at this point in the show, most people who were like online following these message boards already knew, like they knew like a couple seasons ago.
Oh, really?
That John was a Targaryen. But you have kept yourself pure.
Yeah, how would they, was it just something that they surmised or?
So, yeah, so there's this major fan theory early on that, you know, Martin's dropped these hints in the books that the John is actually the son of Lyanna and Rhaegar. And of course, you know, you've got millions of people following these breadcrumbs. Someone's going to come up with the right theory, right?
Right.
And then the question is how much traction the theory is going to get. And so as they're revealing these little breadcrumbs throughout the series, you know, people start crowing like, I was right. I was right. And then people who are just kind of casual show watchers get robbed of an experience. But Steve, you were not robbed of that.
I was not robbed of that experience.
So did you, so I'm curious, like, did you sniff that out? Cause you saw Tommen coming. You certainly saw that. You get credit for that. For
sure. Yeah. Well, yeah. But the Tommen thing was more of a, like I said, I feel like there is a definite move towards, Queens. The Kings just haven't cut it. Right. So I was a little surprised that it, you know, and again, things may change down the road, but like, I was a little surprised that Winterfell was just obviously given to Jon. I mean, I understand from sort of the male-female dynamic in the series, but I kind of felt like, you know, Littlefinger, you know, what he was pushing towards, like, might have been onto something, right? Uh-huh.
But you thought Tommen was going out because you thought either Margaery or Cersei's going to sit the throne, right?
Right.
And you got that, like, overnight. But I guess, just to wrap up the Jon Snow business, neither you nor Heather kind of had sniffed out the Jon as a Targaryen.
No, and as soon as you, like, you know, as soon as we see Lyanna in the, you know, in bed, like, that's when it starts to, like, oh, this is going to be, I think this is what this is going to be.
Sure.
This is not, because at first you start to think like, oh, wait a minute, is this, you have this because of the way that the show and the book seems to go. You're like, oh, wait, did Annette and Leanna maybe?
Right. Yeah, it was kind of a passionate reintroduction of those two.
Yeah.
Now, you said that you really liked this episode, but there was a little bit of Dorne.
Oh, yeah. I had my as soon as Dorne shows up. But Lady Olenna telling them they all suck. I'm like, yeah, I'm into that. Lady Olenna.
You look like an angry little boy.
I know. Lady Olenna is great, always, so that helps. And then if she's going to go in there and just throw shade at Dorne, yeah.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwais is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret, Hush Hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim, order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar, then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
And now here's an excerpt of my conversation with medievalist Brian Pavlak. I ask Brian about that final episode of the HBO adaptation where the Council of Lords and Ladies just simply sit around and select Bran as king, because I think that that struck many viewers as implausible. And Brian has an interesting take on this, so I thought I'd include that here.
We used to have such a bad example in Robert, and then a bad example in Joffrey, and Tommen's a non-entity, and Cersei's just evil and incompetent. She does not turn out to be a good ruler because she rules mostly through fear and terror, which again is another way to rule, right? We mentioned before, personal promises. Well, the idea you break your promise, so you cross the person in power. You have fear and terror of being punished, tortured, executed, all these sort of things. And that's how, you know, Joffrey, to some extent, and Cersei buys into it fully. And all of this comes the great theme of the book. Who deserves to be king? And on what basis should kingship be? And we have this strong idea of inheritance, that we shouldn't fuss with the idea of a dynasty. Dynasty is politics through family. And that's the idea that dominates Ned Stark's mind, making him blind to powerful realities, that a young boy maybe is not the best king in these times. And then when he realizes the young boy isn't a king, he says, well, it's got to go to Stannis, who also wasn't going to be the best king if he ever came to power. What is the best king? And the only person who thinks about that is Varys. Who would be the best king?
Right.
And here he is behind the scenes. You know, he has a couple lines in this chapter, sort of snarky lines. But we know he's not snarky because he's been talking to Ned honestly in the prison cell.
Yeah.
So he's the only one who cares about peace in the kingdom, as he says to Ned. And I think that's true. But kings are supposed to be concerned about peace in the kingdom. How do you justify being king through inheritance? And when lines die out, the Targaryens die out, although they don't really, that's why we have another civil war. We have civil wars. So when lines die out, like the Wars of the Roses, is a civil war because the dynasty's in trouble. And that's, you know, what George Martin took to base his book on, this you know, Lancaster versus York becomes the Lannisters versus Stark.
Right.
And a dynasty in trouble. And ultimately what decides it, again, is not just power, but loyalty. Who decides who's going to support whom?
Yeah.
And on what basis, how good a king they're going to be.
Well, I was also going to say that it's also about the narrative, right? Because,
yes,
like, for instance, after Aerys is thrown down, it could have been Ned as king. It could have been Jaime Lannister as king. It could have been Ned, Jon Arryn. It could have been a number of folks. Why was it Robert? Well, Robert has sort of way, way back in his lineage some connection to Targaryen blood, right? So it's almost like, yeah, they're going to overthrow the Targaryen king, the rightful sort of the rightful king, but they need to nod to this particular narrative. They know that the narrative
of inheritance is very powerful. And we can even see in our own days, you know, when we got George W. Bush and we got Hillary Clinton and we got people talking about the Trump children.
Or now we're talking about JFK Jr. all the
time. Oh, QAnon, right? QAnon and JFK Jr. Yeah, the power, and that's the power of dynasty. And that's why dynasty works. And that's why it's so dominant for so long. The best time in the Roman Empire, I teach my students, is not when children inherited power. Was during the five good emperors when they had adoption and succession.
Right.
Where an emperor would adopt someone.
Sure.
And then someone who was talented, and that person would become an emperor because he was the son of the previous emperor, but through adoption. And of course, the great movie Gladiator shows how that is then destroyed under Marcus Aurelius. And the son takes over and things go to crap. And that's, you know, there's a lot of historical validity in that, even though the Gladiator character is made up. And we have the idea, of course, now of election. But kings were elected in the Middle Ages quite often, especially when dynasties died out. And they didn't necessarily have to have the best connection to the previous dynasty. Maybe just a good connection, and sometimes hardly any connection at all. Because
okay, tell me more about that. How did such elections happen?
Well, the collection I studied most, because I wrote this biography of a bishop, Archbishop Albero of Montreuil. He is a prince archbishop. He commanded armies, although at the he had military forces under his command. And the dynasty dies out. Henry V, emperor, the son of the previous emperor, Henry IV, was the son of the previous emperor, Henry III, was the son of the previous emperor. So had a dynasty going on, but Henry V dies without children. His wife was the empress, and she goes off and marries, wants to become Queen of England, but that doesn't work out. And that's the English Civil War. All sorts of fascinating stuff there. But so there are two main families, two dominant families. It's against Lannister versus York. The two dominant families are the Stauffens and the Welfs.
Hmm.
and they both have powerful territories. They both have royal connections because everybody's marrying everyone. I mean, you're related to all the other powerful families, including royalty. But the Stauffens were most loyal to the previous king. The Welfs wanted to be more independent, sort of a repeat of this whole Lancaster York, Lannister Stark thing. And at first, the Welfs claimed to be king because they grabbed the title and they tried to get their guy elected first. Mm-hmm. But Albero, my bishop, actually likes the Stauffens and tries to get the Stauffen elected. And so there's some negotiation and fighting and problems.
So we have
going
this
on.
Bishop who is trying to throw his political weight behind
right,
one of
behind
these.
One candidate or another. Yeah, and sure. Eventually they compromise and the Welf candidate sort of wins for a while. But when he dies, the Stauffens take over. But then the Welfs keep coming back and trying to defy and take power back from the Stauffens. So this is long-running civil war, which lasts a couple generations, that basically destroys the German monarchy, especially the popes start stepping in and the popes start saying who should be king. And so we have England, which develops a strong kingship working with parliament. France, which develops a strong kingship, at least first working with the Estates General, but then they get rid of that. And the German kings become weaker and weaker and weaker. And all this depends on these dynasties as they're fighting over who is becoming kings and on what basis you get elections. And when mm-hmm. the Stauffens die out and the Welfs become unimportant, then arises in Germany the seven prince electors, three bishops and four princes who basically elect the monarchy. Unfortunately, the inheritance principle is so powerful that they begin electing Habsburgs one after another. And soon the Habsburgs just become elected pro forma. But technically, they still have to be elected. And there are a couple times when they don't get elected.
All right. So when this is going to happen, is there mm-hmm. like, I mean, who gets to be on the nominating, you know, talking about like church politics, who gets to be on like the king nominating committee? Who gets to like have the vote? Who
the powerful?
How is this determined?
The powerful and great people, and it's determined really by the historical circumstances. So, like when I was high school too, I was a big war gamer, and an Avalon Hill war game came out. So we were on boards and we played with little tokens and rolled dice and stuff like that. You know, real war gaming back in the day. And there was a game that came out called Kingmaker. It was about the Wars of the Roses.
Mm-hmm.
It's about Earl of Warwick. Was the kingmaker because he was behind either supporting King Henry VI, the Lancasters, or bringing in the Yorkists. And he was basically playing a role deciding on them. And the game was getting all the other players either playing him and or other royal families over who's going to control who becomes king. And that's, again, what George Martin took to turn into the Game of Thrones. And it all depends on who's powerful. For a moment, it looks like it's going to be Robb Stark. Well, we know what happened to him.
Yeah.
And
sure.
Then for a moment, you know, at the end, and I don't take the last season as canon. I'm still waiting for Martin mm-hmm. to turn out that last damn book. But various people step up and become players. And that's the whole, you know, the next volumes is basically player after player after player who either survives to continue playing a little bit or wipes out. And of course, Cersei becomes the dominant player because she's shrewd. But she's ultimately not a good ruler. And
well, let me ask you this, because I feel like probably people listening might have the same question. I think that the show got criticized a lot because it seemed very implausible that it would just be, you know, a bunch of lords and ladies sitting in a circle deciding who is going to be the next king. So what you're saying is that that's not as implausible. If a dynasty ends, if a line ends, you would indeed have a group of powerful people just simply select the next king.
Yes, I think that's not the part that bothered me. The part was they selected Bran. How could this otherworldly non-human? Because so much of kingship was personal relationships. Uh-huh. No one can relate to Bran, although. You know, Tyrion says, well, he can tell stories. Okay, he can tell stories. But he's unrelatable because he's non-human anymore. So that's just
okay.
Weird.
Yeah, but the actual function.
But the idea that the powerfuls get together and say, we don't want a civil war. That's what happened in the Middle Ages at several points. Is we don't want a civil war. Let's make a compromise and settle on it. Now, of course, then circumstances would change as somebody gets married or somebody dies or somebody's born or some invasion happens. And that would, as happens, of course, all through the series of Ice and Fire, changes the game. And we don't know who's then going to be going out coming out because Rob could have become king. But you know, that didn't happen. And we, nobody, I think, expected Cersei to become queen, but she made it happen.
Sure.
And yes, a bunch of people sitting down, they were all the dominant people. They can make everybody obey because they held the power between them and they decided to work it out. I think that is completely plausible.
Sure.
That's the part that
That's interesting. I don't think I've heard that take before, and I think that this is actually why I have medieval historians on this podcast.
And when the key is they had to be selfless, right? They themselves, like one of the deadliest sins, you know, is pride. And they themselves had to decide, my pride, my selfishness is not going to dominate. Like the previous meeting of them all, when Cersei says, yes, I'm going to help you fight the undead. And of course, she was lying through her teeth. Right?
Right.
She was So she was going to play the game to the end for herself.
Right.
Sure. But these other guys, the guys who survive, I think they would have kept it, again, until perhaps again the next crisis happened. Because what's going to happen when Bran dies? He's not going to have any children.
Well, see, that was my question.
They could.
Yeah, I think that that's what I think a lot of folks, I think that there is an inclination, there was sort of a hint throughout the series that the structure of the government had to change.
Yes.
And so you have like Dany often saying, you know, break the wheel. And then I think it's open to interpretation what she actually means by that.
I don't think she understood this, you know.
Right. And then, of course, you have someone like Varys who sort of, he presents himself as someone who actually cares and represents the common folk because no one else will, you know. Or then you have, every now and again, you'll like see a little glimpse into like, well, how does the Night's Watch, you know, have a new Lord Commander? Well, that's pretty democratic, or at least it looks that way on the surface.
Right.
So you've got these little hints. And then, of course, that last episode elects Bran and you're left to wonder afterwards, like, oh, is it just going to be always the three-eyed raven forevermore? Who's now the king?
I guess that's one solution, to have a magical ruler. Because, of course, another common concept of kings, and we've seen this, of course, with many recent politicians. Yeah,
divine blood or something.
Exactly. Right? Or they're treated like gods, right? They claim to have divine blood, or they are divine, like the pharaohs. Or they're treated like a god.
The argument for the Targaryens, right? That they're actually a different kind of a species, and the rules don't apply to them, and
that was their advantage. And we'll see. You know, I'm curious as to how they illustrate this in the new series. But having read Fire and Blood, which again is the reason why Game of Thrones is so popular, and that book was not. It was written like an historian. It was written like a history book, and you know, history books are often boring, and it just didn't have the life and the fire that the Song of Ice and Fire has. So I hope they bring it to life in the series.
So you're saying that Fire and Blood lacked both fire and blood.
It did, in the sense of being inspiring and exciting and interesting to read. I had to drag my way through it. In the same sense that I'm reading The Silmarillion again right now, Tolkien.
Sure.
That's a hard slog. And there's great stuff that happens, but his language is so archaic, it slows.
Well, I think it's an issue of expectations. You know, when I sit down to read through Josephus, if I think that I'm going to be reading something that is, I think that you have to right size your expectations.
Yes.
Going into it, there's some really interesting stuff in history books like that. And yet you really have to attune yourself to the style of writing to get it.
Yes.
And, you know, it very well could be that it's something that George felt like he needed to have in place in order to finish the book. I think it's more likely that he thought, well, I can get this prequel deal in place if I finish this book. And that's, you know, I think eventually George realized that in addition to being a novelist, he was a producer of content. And you can get, there's a lot of money to be made if you can get this thing on the screen.
Yes.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the Shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, as a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I will revisit again the question of where is the climax in a Game of Thrones? And of course, shout out to my friend JJ, who tells me that I'm overthinking this. Yes, JJ, I'm probably overthinking this. Both Dragonwalker and Jane think that Littlefinger's betrayal of Ned in the throne room is the climax of the book. And I think that that's where I was leaning. And maybe I'm still leaning that direction. Justin thinks that it's Cersei's you win or you die proclamation in the garden to Ned. He thinks that the story really turns after that. And I see that as a setup, Justin. It doesn't have the feeling of a climax to me. The email that most got me thinking was from Melanie. So I'll just go ahead and read Melanie's email. I've never emailed feedback for any Bald Move podcast to date, so you should feel special. I do indeed feel special, Melanie. Thank you. The question you posed about the climax of a Game of Thrones got me thinking, though. And I don't think that there's one single climax. Since the story is told from the perspective of multiple characters, with multiple arcs in multiple locations, the structure doesn't lend itself to the traditional exposition rising action, climax, falling action, resolution structure. So Melanie's basically arguing that because it's a multiple POV book, it doesn't easily fall into that particular structure. She continues. On top of that, it's a series where conflict leads to conflict, which leads to more conflict. Just think of A Storm of Swords, which contains the Red Wedding, Joffrey being killed, Tyrion's arrest with a trial and the trial by combat, Littlefinger pushes Lysa out the moon door, Tyrion kills Tywin and Shae, the Battle of the Wall, and so many more huge climactic moments. There's no way to say that there is a climax in A Storm of Swords because it's just too awesome for one climax. Since the Game of Thrones has the least number of POV characters and plot lines, I will give it a shot and say that Ned's beheading is the climax of the book for Arya, Sansa, Catelyn, and Robb. The story shifts to them dealing with the fallout of that major dramatic event and changes everything for all of them. I think that the climax of Dany's arc is when Jorah carries her into that tent. I think that the dragon's hatching is actually resolution to her first book storyline, despite it being the biggest, most dramatic moment for her. Jon and Tyrion are harder because it feels like we are still in rising action. The trial by combat at the Eyrie, I guess, could be the climax, but then we go meet up with Tywin and immediately start setting the table for the next book. Jon burns the white, but then he tries to desert and acts like a dumb teenager. Neither of these events seems particularly climactic for characters, let alone the whole book. Anyway, I hope you read this email, since I brushed off my high school English knowledge of storytelling just for you. I'm loving the podcast. Thank you, Melanie. I really appreciate it. And I think I agree with most of what you're saying here. Yes, I think we need to measure these things differently because there's so many different storylines. I don't think that your argument that if there are multiple POVs, then there can't be a single climax. I think that even with the multiple POVs, you're telling a single story. You're just telling in the way that you construct a mosaic rather than paint a picture, I guess. But you're still building. And I think that this is even more true for this book than a book like Storm of Swords. Ned's beheading has the natural feeling of a climax for most of the characters in the book. And I think that you and I might agree on this. It's just a very odd way to portray the event. Maybe JJ's right. Maybe I'm overthinking this. Maybe it is Ned's beheading. Maybe that's it. And George simply has understated the climax. As a result, I think this book gives us a peak experience that continues to rise and has two, three, maybe even four peaks at the top. So while Jane is probably right that there's multiple climaxes in this book, it absolutely does follow the traditional exposition of rising action, climax, falling action, and then resolution structure. And I agree with Dragonwalker that the dragons emerging at the end is really the resolution of this book and setting up for future storylines. Still no word from George on this, although I'm not going to give up. All right, then. That is how we end Season 6 of Electric Boogaloo.